Sounds True presents Experiments in Truth, Session 7, Living Spirit, Open Heart, Part 1 with Ram Dass, a talk recorded live at a retreat held in Yucca Valley, California, in March of 1979.
Since the road that leads to perdition is wide and spacious, and many take it, but it is a narrow gate and a hard road that leads to life. It leads to life, and only a few find it. The pull of the world, the pull of desires, the pull of the solidity of the senses and the thinking mind, it's a wide gate. The pull of the spirit seems to be a narrow gate until you're on it. And then it becomes the only way. The power of the way, says the Tao, the power of the way, meaning the living spirit, will come into you when you are empty, like a valley or canyon, and therefore receptive to it. You will then be sensitive equally to good and bad as they concern you, and will be able to test everything for its worth. In the end, you will come to terms with the effortless worth that is located in the distant past. In the end, you will be like the valley, which is the favorite resort of the way. Becoming receptive, becoming soft, becoming open, becoming tuned, becoming quiet. And also from the Tao, the line, there are ways, but the way is uncharted. Meaning there are methods, but the living spirit has no map. And all the methods to take you from here to there are based on what it looks like from the beginning of the journey to even conceive of a there. For the spirit cannot be conceived of. It just is. It just is. You and I have started a journey, maybe in this lifetime, maybe in past lifetimes. We've touched the relative nature of the physical universe. Once one touches it, the next question any Westerner asks is, what do I do about it? How do I have it for my own? And the answer, of course, is that you can't have it for your own. You can just become it. You can die into it, but you cannot control the living spirit. You have an experience of high, a moment later it is a memory. It's another moldering butterfly to add to your collection. So every time you grab an experience of a high and cling to it, you are just putting a thought form between you and the living spirit. Because any memory you've held on to of the high moment in your life is keeping you from this moment. And right here is the living spirit. If not here, then nowhere. This isn't preparation for later. You're not collecting this for somewhere else. This is what it's about, right this second. Everything you've been in all your incarnations, everything you've learned in life, what you ate for breakfast, all of it, preparation for this moment here, right now. This is it. This is it. Until there is the spaciousness that says, yes, ah, so. This is it, ah. Ugly, beautiful, boring, confused, dead, angry, dark night of the soul, brilliant light spirit, just the way it is. And in just the way it is the spirit. not in the way you think it ought to be. So you grab at it, and you grab at experiences, and it's called spiritual materialism. And you get some powers because you see more than other people see, because you're a little quieter than other people are, and you see the relative nature of reality, so you don't get quite as stuck, and you get powers. And you've always felt inadequate and not good enough, so you love your powers and you play with them. And you say, I'll do that for righteousness. I'll do it for the good of all people, but it's still you using your powers. And finally, you using powers takes you from the living spirit. And you'll find that. You can't be told that, because you'll still want to play. But you will find, as you play, that moment when everybody's saying, oh, you're wonderful, do it to me. And you're busy, I will do it to you. You will feel how far you are. And then you will not be able to stand. See, once you have tasted of what it's like to be with a beloved, to be in the spirit, you can't stand it. You can't stand to be away. And finally, your own hypocrisy about any stance you take of being holy or being spiritual or being powerful or any place where you begin to be somebody is solidifying, it's calcifying, it's concretizing, it's taking you from the living spirit, and you can't afford it anymore. Just telling you how it is. You know, this is just the way things are. And so you kind of get a little discouraged, and your faith flickers. Because you had the experience, you thought you knew, you took a stance to represent how you thought it was, and then suddenly it's all dead. And horrible, and ugly, and empty. And your faith flickers, and you say, I've lost it. And at times when the faith flickers and you're part of an organization or a belief system or a technique, that's when you become more fanatic. In order to reinforce your flickering faith, you try to convince everybody else that it's true. So when you feel that fanaticism in another human being, you almost know immediately that their faith is flickering. Because when the faith in what you're doing is perfect, when you just are what you are, you don't have to convince anybody of anything. Faith flickers, and it's often followed by what's called the dark night of the soul. I lost it. You have depression. And then you say, well, I'll just go back into the world because the whole thing was phony anyway. The whole spiritual trip was a hype. And all those people in the world that said there was nothing to it were right, because I've lost it and I'm not going to get screwed by not having anything. At least I'll have the world. So you go back into whatever part of the world you can grab onto again. And that's called, as Krishnadas once said to me, the phony unholy as opposed to the phony holy. Because the problem is that once it's happened, you can't forget it. You might try, you might sit at a bar and drink and lust and talk about soccer and fast cars and look for rushes and trips and more rushes and trips. But you won't be able to forget, because once you've awakened, you can't get back to sleep fully. You can do pretty well. You do pretty well, but you can't do it totally. You just can't do it totally. And at this time, because you have this heightened awareness and this ability to stand back a little bit from your whole trip, you begin to explore all of the things that you've held in before. And you explore relationships, and you explore sexuality, and you call it Tantra. And and you sort of see what you can get and what you can enjoy. And you come back much more into enjoying. You see, the problem was that a pendulum must swing. And when you first have the experience that awakens, then you read about the spiritual models and you hear about them and you buy them with your mind, because the Western intellect is so leading the heart that you tend to buy how you ought to be ahead of when you're there. So you buy that I ought to be, say, a renunciate. And a horny celibate is no closer to God than a person that is acknowledging. In fact, the person that's acknowledging their lust is, from my point of view, closer to God than a horny celibate. And so after the pendulum went to one side of being appearing to be something, the phony holy, now it swings the other way and there's the phony unholy. Because you pushed away your fascination with the world prematurely and you're still fascinated. You still want to know what's happening. You're still looking outside in the world for something. You're looking for love. You're looking for relationship. You're looking for stimulation. You're looking for knowledge. You're looking for a titillation. And as long as you're looking for any of that, you're pulled into the world. As long as there's anything that your eyes can tell you, or your ears can tell you, or your nose, or your tongue, or your skin can tell you, or your thinking mind can know, you're still being pulled into the world. And there's no way you can make believe that you are not and get on with it. You've got to be the incarnation you are. And the more true you are about where you are, the faster the transformation happens. That's the karma of it. I'm just describing karma. I'm not talking about will. I'm talking about karma. I mean, I know lots of people who went through an awakening, joined groups, chanted, prayed, went to ashrams, and now they are scuba diving and having cars, fast cars, and just living very much in the world and looking for more and more trips and more sexual exploration with their extended marriages and so on. And I see them having to have a certain state of mind of a slight cynicism they have to hold on to be able to play that one out. But they have to play it out, and when they finish playing it out, they will be done. And you can feel that they've finished, but they don't want to give up. You try to milk it for one more rush, one more trip, just I can get a little more out of it. I mean, it was good all those years. Why not once more? And when the trips start to fall away, if you're like me, you get really feeling angry and depressed and gypped. Because you look around and everybody, you see that ignorance is bliss. You see that everybody's getting fun out of bowling and you don't want to bowl anymore. And you don't have anything else. It's the dark night of the soul when you have lost the world and you're not yet tasting deeply enough of the spirit. And it's a heavy period. There are a lot of heavy periods in this journey. And comes along with all this a kind of a deeper and a deeper understanding, a wisdom, a deeper wisdom. So you're understanding sort of how it all is and why this is all happening, and that yes, the trips will fall away and it still hurts because there are still the veils of attachment, of still wanting not to die into the spirit. Because the awakening was merely the foreshadowing of the death into living spirit. It's not the death. It's just the foreshadowing of the death. I'm just describing to you the stages of dying into spirit. Because only when you are spirit is there no death and no birth. And then you are. And you become who you truly are. And it's at this point, as you understand more and you see your predicament and you're acting out all your stuff, that your understanding of the way karma works makes it almost impossible for you to continue to act in ways which exploit others or which create karma for other human beings. And it starts to temper your behavior. The commandments start to be real for you, not as things you ought to follow, which is the way you've done it all your life. I ought to be good. As if you need to have these external controls to repress the internal stuff that is not acceptable to you. And finally, all of the precepts or the commandments or whatever they are become sort of obvious to you about that's the way life has to be, because that's the way it works. It's merely a statement of how it works. Because the more karma you create, the deeper you dig your hole of suffering. It's as simple as that. And there is a point where you really want to clean up your act. And you start to look for fire of purification. And that's when it gets very interesting, because you begin to think that lurking in you was a tremendous masochist. Because suddenly you are looking towards those situations that push you, that push your buttons, press your buttons, instead of running away as everybody else does and as you've always done, you suddenly sit right with them. And you say, boy, is it hot. In the Ramayana, in the Valmiki version of the Ramayana, when Ram, God, has finally rescued Sita, his wife, from the bad guy, Ravana, and they are together, some people start to whisper it abroad that after all, she lived with this bad guy for quite a while, and she probably wasn't true to Ram. She probably made it with him, the bad guy. And she says she doesn't, but Ram is the perfect king at this point, and he realizes that if there is dissension among his people, that that's not being the perfect king, and that he's got to do something about this. And he's confused as to what to do, and Sita says to him, look, I have been totally pure in this, but if there's any doubt, build a huge fire, and I'll walk and stand in the middle of the fire. And if I've done anything wrong, I'll be burned, because impurity will get burned. And they build a fire, and she stands in the middle, and not even the tip of her sari gets burned, or of her dress. She just stands there, because gold is not affected by the fire, while all the impurities get burned away. So you begin to see that life's experiences will only be too hot for you if there is a you that's trying to protect yourself. The living spirit is not vulnerable to life's experiences. So when you are who you truly are, what fire is too hot? That's what Christ pointed out. He said, look, watch, I'll get nailed up. Far out, see, you think you're doing something to me? Call me names, laugh at me, psychological taunting. You can even kill me, go ahead. I'm not vulnerable. It isn't who I am. He was making a clear statement about what living spirit is about. And since you know the handwriting is in the wall of who you're going to become, finally the purification process just goes on and on. Not in a heavy way, not in a righteous way. Not in a righteous way. Not in a, I've got to do this to myself. And getting tight about it. Not that way at all. Very humorous, delightful, playful, soft way. The minute you get ahead of yourself, you'll be righteous. So a lot of our job is slowing down enough to let our heart come into harmony with our minds so we don't keep getting ahead of ourselves. We don't keep getting ahead of ourselves. So you clean up your work, and the cleaning up is what goes on and on until the very end. And sometimes you've got a lot of psychological stuff to clean up. And it gets weird because you're living in a world at that point where suffering is something to be avoided, and yet you are experiencing suffering as grace, and you begin to feel very strange. Because at that point, your suffering, or just the way life has been handed to you, is absolutely just the way it is. And no longer are you saying, it ought to be thus and so. You're just taking it as it comes. And at that point, your attitudes towards everything in life start to change. Your attitudes towards pain, towards death, towards abortion, towards the end of the world, towards all of it, just keeps changing and changing and changing. Because you're looking at it from an entirely different vantage point. You are now in the world, but no longer primarily of the world. The balance has shifted in terms of your consciousness moving from outside inside. At this point, some of your forms of livelihood change because you look for ways to earn your living in a way to be dharmic. And sometimes you stay right in the same games, but the whole quality of the game changes. And you can be a lawyer, but it's a new kind of law. You can be a everything, but it's a new kind of everything. I was at a meditation retreat, and we hadn't started the retreat yet. And we could talk just those few minutes before the retreat began. And I was in one of the bunks, and he was in another bunk in the same room. And I said to this fellow, what do you do? And he said, I'm a vice president in a bank in San Francisco in charge of industrial loans. And he says, but it's an interesting story. He said, I was a vice president in a San Francisco bank in charge of industrial loans 10 years ago. And then I couldn't handle it anymore. And I dropped out and I left my family and I left the job and I went off and I took a lot of acid and I wrote poetry and I lived in communes. And I did that for about 8 years. And he said, then one day I was walking through San Francisco and I met the president of the bank. And he said, gee, isn't it amazing that I met you today? It turns out that your desk is open again and you were the best vice president we've ever had. Would you consider coming back? And I thought, why not? So I shaved off my beard and I got my tie and a whole thing and got cleaned up and I went to work. And I said, well, is it any different? He said, it's entirely different. He said, before, I used to be a vice president in charge of industrial loans. Now I'm a being that goes to this place and I hang out with people all day long. And we're together, and the vehicle for us to be together is industrial loans. Right? So instead of hating the job because of his identification, he's now seeing it as a vehicle. And if you can think of a less appealing vehicle from the spiritual point of view, I would find it hard because people come wanting something from you very materially. And yet in every situation is the opportunity to meet living spirit if you are looking with those eyes that see. Because every human being in some way wants to live in the spirit. That's what the whole game is about. And whether they're buying a Cadillac or trying to get a bigger rush, the rushes, if you look at what the rushes are, the rushes are to take you out of yourself. Whether it's sex or motorcycling or scuba diving or cooking a bouillabaisse or whatever it is. It's always to get you to that place where you get out of yourself. I just got so busy crocheting, I just forgot myself. Same space. And you work with that fine line between testing God and trusting God. It's just a very fine line there where you're pushing the limits all the time to see how bad you can be without falling out of grace. Versus getting to the point where you're just allowing it to be and trusting. You're not going to lose it. And you don't have to test it. You just have to surrender and open to it. And it's at this point that you begin to appreciate what it means to start to have a very clean game. And you understand what Don Juan means when he talks about being an impeccable warrior. And how you have to clean up your act so you are clean dharmically on every plane of your game. And that's what we keep hearing. I keep hearing things I've got to clean up. I've just got to clean up this and that. And it's all just a mopping up operation, really. It's just cleaning up the sloppiness in the game. And you get so that if you say you're going to be somewhere, you're there. Personality stops being that interesting to you anymore. Protecting your own power position. You know, and you begin to feel that if somebody else is playing a power trip on you, that's their problem. If you get caught, that's yours. So you begin to see that your job is to be impeccable without demanding that everybody else be impeccable. You don't have to say, I'll only be impeccable if you are. I'll only be on time if you're on time. I'll be on time. If you're late, that's your karma. It's okay. I'll stand and I'll sit with God for a few minutes. Do mantra. And as you get clean, but it's still not the living spirit. It's impeccable, but it's not yet the flip. It's a kind of a plateau that comes. And in the cleaning and impeccability, you begin to see what parts you have to play in your incarnation, what your responsibilities are to parents, to children, to country, to religion, to all of the reference groups of which you're a part, if you're black or if you're Chicano or if you're a woman or a man or whatever, whatever reference group you have to honor that in some way. You don't identify with it. You don't get lost in it, but you have to honor it. And honor it means you have to acknowledge its existence and render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. You have to live with it all. You can't make believe it isn't. Because every time you push something under the rug, there is a karmic cost. And if you're going to be an impeccable warrior, you just got to be an impeccable warrior. And to be impeccable on all planes means that the planes have to all be integrated finally. And so if I go into a plane of consciousness in which I see that you and I are in fact the same person, the same being at some level, we are merely in two different forms of it, then if I come down into the plane of separateness and I act as if you are not the same being, I am not being impeccable across planes, if you understand that. In other words, I'm impeccable here and impeccable there, but I'm not impeccable here and there at the same moment. Now, what does it mean to live here with the knowledge that you and I are one? Well, it's a fierce one, and it leads to a lot of changes in lifestyle. It leads to things like voluntary simplicity. It leads to a simplifying of life, because a lot of stuff you look at, like, for example, I'm connected with a thing called the SEVA Foundation, which is concerned with blindness in the world. I know, from the meetings in which this was discussed, I know that there are 60,000 people in India at this moment who are blind. It means they have to be led around. They're totally not able to be part of the workforce, except in a very, very peripheral way. And their blindness could be alleviated by a 4-minute operation that would cost $5. Now, if you can imagine what it's like, just close your eyes for a second and feel what it's like to be blind. Okay? And think of living your life this way, knowing that for 4 minutes and $5, you could have your sight back. Okay? Now, when you know that statistic, what did you use your last $5 for? Or is that person that's blind them? Or is it us? And if it was you that was blind and you had $5, would you use your $5 to heal that blindness? Or would you use the $5 to go to a movie? You wouldn't go to a movie if you were blind, to buy a pizza? How about to buy an extra shirt? How about to put a third of a tank of gas in your car to go riding for the afternoon with somebody else driving, I assume? You begin to see the relative nature of the values and how it changes the minute you realize there's no them, there's only us. The following words of Gandhi are in large letters at the shrine area of his cremation place in Rajghat. These are cut in stone. Recall the face of the poorest and the most helpless man whom you've seen, and ask yourself if the step you contemplate is going to be of any use to him. Will he be able to gain anything by it? Will it restore him to control over his own life and destiny? That's a hard one, to run each act you perform through that. And if it's done from the wrong level, it's righteous. And if it's righteous, there is anger, because you feel you're losing something. And if there is anger, you're ultimately hurting that man, even as you're helping him. So remember the timing of the game. Don't get ahead of yourself. Just keep it all in mind. Don't get ahead of yourself. It's such a delicate dance. Such a delicate dance. But at the point where you begin to have the wisdom to see all these planes and realize that there is no way to stand when you're just open to not standing anywhere, every act you perform is Taoist, is in the Dharma. It comes out of the totality of your inner being, because each of us has to find the way we will manifest. You can't manifest the way I manifest. You can't mimic or imitate another human being. You've got to hear what your unique position is. There are people that are at a moment in history where they are just at a place where they have an opportunity to play a part. Like Lincoln played in relation to slavery. And Maharaji said, you know, Lincoln was a great president. And I said, yes, Maharaji, he was. And he said, because he knew that Christ was president, he was only acting president. Okay. Are you a mother? God is the mother. You are only acting mother. Do you have money? It's God's money. I'm only the treasurer of the corporation. It's a whole other sense of identity about your relationship to the forms of the universe. To be impeccable begins to appreciate your identities in your family, in your country, to all humanity, to the cosmos, to the earth, and so on. It was a time when Mahatma Gandhi was the senior advisor to the Congress Party in India, and the English had become very oppressive, extremely oppressive to the Indians. And the Indians finally realized they just had to get rid of the British. Here were the British, the most powerful nation in the world. And they came to Gandhi, the Congress Party came to Gandhi, and they said, "Would you help us? What do you suggest we do?" And he said, "I don't know." He said, "I'll have to meditate on it." And he went into meditation, and after a week they came and they said, "Well, Mahatmaji, what do we do?" And he said, "I don't know. I'm still meditating on it." And a month and a half later, they were all totally furious because politicians want to have an action to take. And he kept stalling and stalling, saying, "I haven't heard it yet." And finally he came out and he said, "I heard it." And he just started walking towards the ocean. The British had imposed a tax on the Indian people, a salt tax, which meant that they had to buy salt from a British company, even though salt was readily available in India. And each Indian family had to spend up to 2 weeks of their income for salt a year, because it's a hot country and they needed the salt. And Mahatma Gandhi just started marching with his followers, with about 70 people, towards the ocean, and pretty soon more and more people joined them and people were lining the path. And he just went there and he finally got to the ocean. And he went in and he took his bath, purification in the mother in the ocean. And then he came back up and he walked up on the shore and he reached down and he picked up a handful of salt, which God had deposited on the ocean edge. But he was mining his own salt. He was breaking the British law. And that one act of picking up a handful of salt, within a month, 60,000 Indians had been imprisoned for mining their own salt. And that single act was the major turning point in breaking the back of the British. The most powerful country in the world, one scrawny old man went and reached down and picked up one handful of salt. And his statement is important, I think, for us. He said about that act, he said, "There comes a time when an individual becomes irresistible and his or her action becomes all pervasive in its effect. This comes when the person reduces himself or herself to zero." He wasn't doing the act. The act was merely being done through him. Whole interesting space. Because he knew Christ was president. He was only acting president. That's the zero part of it. And Gandhi also said, "God demands nothing less than complete self-surrender as the price for the only real freedom that is worth having. And when a person thus loses self, that person immediately finds self in the service of all that lives. Such service becomes his delight and recreation or recreation. He is a new man or she is a new woman, never weary of spending himself or herself in the service of God's creation," which is the statement, "Not my, but thy will, O Lord." And how that manifests into daily life. I went through a period where I felt that my work was to just quiet my mind and open my heart. And I took courses and I spent time in India and I meditated. And then I felt I could hear Maharaji saying, Maharaji used to say to me, "Ram Dass, You shouldn't be with people very much. You should be alone. You should take your food alone. You should eat alone. You should be alone. So I went back to the hotel after he said that, and I put a sign up in my door, do not disturb, and I stayed in my room. And 2 days later, a couple that was with us had a fight during the night. The next morning they were with Maharaji, and Maharaji said, you were fighting? And they said, yes. And when were you fighting? During the night. Well, did you go to Ram Dass? No, he had a sign, do not disturb. You didn't go to Ram Dass? He wasn't there for you? And he looked at me with disgust. And I was about to say to him, but Maharaji, you said I'm supposed to be alone. And in those conflicting messages is the message. Because at first, you have to be alone by pulling back from people. And you do it, and then you pull back, and then you hear Maharaji saying, serve people, feed people, so you come out. And then you get stuck in the being with people, and you pull back. But you understand what the game is. Finally, the game is to be with people and yet always be alone. You always sit. You always rest in your own being. Maharaji said, your only friend is God. And you ultimately stop looking for it all out in the world because you're just busy being it. You just are it. Then you're ready to do what needs to be done. Your body and your mind and your heart become merely instruments of the process. For a long time in the 60s, there was a great schism between the social action people and the spiritual people. And you either joined Hare Krishna or you went and fought the Chicago police. And everybody was misunderstanding everybody else. And we all knew everybody was a good guy, but it was, you're not a good guy like I'm a good guy, so it's not good enough. And then over the years, our compassion deepened a little bit. And we began to hear each other much better. Because we were busy denying another part of ourselves. And a lot of the people that were in the political activist group realized that as long as they were acting out of anger to change something, out of the anger of the injustice, they were perpetuating the anger. That an angry person lives in an angry world. And that somehow they had to be able to make a strong statement of opposition to another human being and yet have love in their hearts for that other being at the same moment. And they realized that, they understood it, and they started to work on themselves. And on the other side of the coin, those of us that were busy finding ourselves quiet and peaceful, but realized we hadn't honored our incarnation, and we had to take part in the play of the world more and more. And I found myself about a year ago at the Rocky Flats nuclear plant protesting with a group of people, and I participated in the writing of a statement. We all went to Rocky Flats and just sat in meditation right in the middle of the protest. Just sat down and breathing in, breathing out, and then walking meditation, then sitting meditation for about 3 hours. And it rained and everything, and we just sat there. We are meditating here today because we feel that a quiet mind and an open heart are the optimum conditions for social change. What we want to say is that we have no enemies, either here at Rocky Flats or across the Pacific Ocean. We are all part of the same organism, striving in our own ways to maintain the health and unity of the whole. It is the nature of our beings as individuals that defines the quality and power of the statement. By focusing on each breath, we are affirming the dignity of life in the simplest way possible. We extend our compassion to those everywhere who live in fear of nuclear annihilation, and may we all experience clarity of mind and learn to share it constructively with each other. Now, social action is only one part of the dance, because we face anywhere from another 5 minutes to, in some cases, maybe another 50 years of experiences in life. And those experiences may go in any direction. There may be some terrible holocaust. Maybe there'll be a nuclear bomb dropped in Chicago, and it'll spread over every place, and all of us will become diseased and will become crippled and maimed, and we'll spend years in suffering. And maybe there'll be years of peace and prosperity, and we will all have to deal with the experiences of plenty and the discontinuity of us having plenty and others not. And you've got to stay conscious at all these levels all at once. Whatever experiences are going to come down the pike, as people say to me, is the Armageddon coming? Or is this the Aquarian age and it's all starting, at the beginning of the new age, or is it all going to hell? And I answer sort of like Ramana Maharshi answered. Ramana Maharshi's answer was, what are you worried about the future for? You can't even be in the present. Because if you're in the present moment, that's the best preparation you can do for being in the future, for whatever the future will hold. If you're living right here consciously, that's the optimum strategy for preparing for the future. Because if I say to you, the world is going to end, I just have information that the button has been pushed and the bombers are coming and it's going to land here in like 3 minutes. What are you going to do? Go to the toilet? You're going to call home? You're going to pray? Because everything you have been up to this moment, it's that thing about Gandhi in the railway station, my life is my message. That was his message. My life is my message. Whatever you are at this moment has to be ready to die and ready to live. And if you're not, you get on with it, because that's the only thing you can do for however the world's going to come out. Like Uspensky describes in Search of the Miraculous, how he's decided he's going to stay conscious. See? And he's walking down the street saying, I, Uspensky, am walking down the street. And he turns into a certain street and he says, I am turning into this street. He's walking down the street and suddenly he sees the shop of his tobacconist. And he thinks, oh, I'm out of pipe tobacco. And he goes in and he gets the pipe tobacco and he goes on. He completely forgot the whole exercise. And a day and a half later, he remembers he was doing an exercise at the time he saw the tobacconist. And so he starts all over again. You will forget again and again and again and again. You will remember. That's the way the game is designed. That's the process. Because if you didn't ever forget, you wouldn't have taken incarnation in the first place. So don't knock yourself so hard. It's just the way of it. You just keep working with it. So you quiet your mind. And then you open your heart more, more and more and more. See, the way it works with me is it's a lot like judo. Here's the way it works. When I'm around people that are all light and playful and spiritual and all, it's wonderful. I mean, I'm flowing all the time. It's beautiful. But the minute I'm around people who aren't, who are tight and hung up and it's all solid and it's all real and they forgot the folly of it, and they say something solid to me, and sometimes I buy it. I react. And I get caught in the reaction and a heaviness creeps into me. The minute I feel that heaviness, it's just like I dove from air into water. I just went from one medium into another medium that's thicker and heavier. I lost it. I know I lost it at that moment. I may not even know how I lost it. Somebody will walk down the street and I will look at them and there may be a look in them. For example, they may be suffering terribly and I get caught in pity and I lose it into pity. I may get lost into lust and I lose it into lust. I may get caught in anger. I lose it into anger. I may get caught in spiritual greed. I lose it into spiritual greed. Somebody comes along and says, you know, there's a teacher that I can't tell you about the name, but if you are on the street corner at 3rd and Market at a certain time, you will be taken in a car to this place where you'll get a secret initiation that will change everything. And your little heart goes, brrr, see? And it's got you. It's got you. You want something. You lost the faith a little bit. There's a flickery desire. There it is. Grabbed. Every time something grabs in me, I just feel that heaviness start. And the minute the heaviness starts, that heaviness becomes the stimulus that awakens me. I don't even know what I'm heavy about some of the time. I don't even care. I don't even have to get into the content of it. I just feel the heaviness, and I immediately go into whatever my technique is, breathing, mantra. doesn't mean I stop the anger or stop the lust or anything. It goes on, but I am bringing myself into consciousness right in the middle of it because the thing itself awakened me. In judo, the punch of someone else becomes the energy you work with to defeat them. You work with the energy that comes at you by moving with it rather than going against it. And the minute something happens that takes me out of consciousness, that is the vehicle that reminds me to awaken. And you just train yourself so that you get so that you use life that way. It's merely a device because at that point you just want to be with God. It means you want to be in this clear, light, loving, present space. Not even the experience of it, just. So, you and I are going to have the opportunity to have lots of experiences and use them until we get totally liberated, which means the end of our identification with the experiencer. And at that moment, our experiences end because there's nobody to experience them. Then you might hang around and there'll be manifestation coming out of you, but you don't have to worry anymore because you're just God. You're just one with God.
This concludes session 7. Our program continues with session 8.